Yeah, so today we had the pleasure of having Hong Yu from Caltech giving the strong gravity seminar. So Hong has worked on a number of topics in tidal effects in stars and gravitational wave sources. And today he'll be telling us about nonlinear dynamical tides and white dwarf binaries. And so if you have some questions during the talk, our speaker's happy if you just interrupt him. And chime in with them, and then at the end, I'll ask the you. I'll also moderate the questions, and you can just hit the raise hand icon. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Hong. So thanks.
Okay, cool. Thanks for inviting me here. So I'll be talking about nonlinear dynamical tides in white dwarf binaries today. So here is the outline of the talk. So first, I'll give you some motivations. Why do we care about this problem? And also, I'll briefly review some previous studies on this topic. So a key distinction or a key point I want to make is the distinction between how we treat the nonlinear effects. So compare the point is that all the previous studies, they focus when they consider nonlinearity, they focus on this local wave breaking condition, whereas in this study we will be focused on the global parametric instability. So it's really a pleasure for me to be able to talk about this PI at PI. So it's kind of interesting, and so the key here is to get the nonlinear to get some phenomenological model that describes the nonlinear tidal energy dissipation rate. And then we will be using that phenomenological model to study the long-term evolution, like the synchronization and heating of the white dwarf. And also we will study what kind of observational signatures can be derived from these tidal effects. So to start, just let me give you some motivations for the topic. So first, why do we care about white dwarfs? Well, I mean, there are a whole bunch of them out there. So it's good for us to understand those sources. And they're very important sources for future spaceborne gravitational wave observatories like LISA and TiangO. So I think most of you probably heard about this LISA mission. And TiangO is a new concept we're developing at Caltech. So I'll sneak in later a slide to give you a better idea on what this TiangO mission is. And then back to white dwarfs. So they're important also because they're believed, or at least some people believe that they're progenitors for type 1a supernovae. And for those less massive systems, they can also evolve into AM-CVN systems, and that's also interesting. And currently, there are lots of those systems being discovered by surveys like ELM and CTF. So here on the top we show like the discovery paper for this 12-minute system, JO651, and we will talk about the system a lot later in the talk. And also very recently, there's also a discovery of a 7-minute system.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we still just see your title slide.
You're is that the case? Let's
Ah,
see.
there you go.
Okay, then probably I just don't do the full screen. Can you see things fine here?
Now we see motivations.
Great. I'm just seeing like right now, I mean, there are many new white dwarf systems being discovered. Like there's this 12-minute or 30-minute one, and then also there's like 7-minute one discovered very recently by CTF. And also there are a whole bunch of previous studies on the tidal interactions in those systems, and they all show that tide play a very significant role in affecting the evolution of the system. So that's basically why we want to study tides there. So to be, let me first give you a brief over. So before we go to the nonlinear tide, let me first give you overview of the linear tidal theory. So it is very convenient to decompose the linear tide into two components. So there will be an equilibrium tide, so that corresponds to the large scale distortion of the star, and in the equilibrium tide, the fluid basically follows the equipartition of the equipotential of the companion instantaneously. So when people talk about tidal interactions in neutron stars, say like in the LIGO context, it is this equilibrium tide that plays the most important role. And then on the other hand, there's also dynamical tide. So that corresponds to the tidally excited internal waves inside the star. And for white dwarfs specifically, the waves we're interested in are supported by gravity and buoyancy. So they're also known as gravity waves or GMOs. So as we shall see shortly, is that it is this dynamical tide that's responsible for tidal dissipation in the system. And for inspiring white dwarfs, is this tidal dissipation that plays the most significant, the most important role in the long-term evolution. So here on slide 5 in the plot, we show the propagation diagram for a white dwarf. So let's just focus on the top panel. And actually, can you guys see my mouse as well?
Yes.
Okay. Great. So let's just focus on the top panel here. Here, this solid trace is the buoyancy frequency, and the dashed trace is the lump frequency. So the lump frequency is essentially it's proportional to the inverse of local sun crossing time. And for the gravity waves we're interested in, they can propagate when its frequency is less than both the buoyancy frequency and the lump frequency. So now we can imagine that the wave actually propagates inside the cavity. And if the wave's amplitude is sufficiently small and the damping is very weak, then we can imagine the wave gets reflected at the boundary of the cavity. And that leads to essentially a discrete set of standing waves inside this cavity. It's just like a photon in your optical cavity. It's a very similar idea. And then those standing waves, they basically correspond to the eigenmodes of the white dwarf. And then that's the linear theory. And then as the orbit shrinks and the orbital separation gets closer and closer, and the tide amplitude keeps increasing, eventually the mode amplitude can be so high that the shear exceeds unity. So that happens very close to the surface of the star usually. And for gravity waves, a larger than unity shear means that the perturbed fluid overturns the background stratification. And this background stratification is what supports the original oscillation. So in other words, the wave will break at the location where its shear exceeds unity. And so that's essentially the nonlinear effect considered by the previous study. Like there's a whole bunch of study by Fuller and Lai. So in order to capture this like local wave breaking phenomena, they treated the wave as a one-way traveling wave inside the star. So the tide excites some wave and this wave propagates inside star and gets perfectly absorbed at the surface. And so in addition to this, this like local wave breaking that corresponds to the strongly nonlinear limit. And so in between this linear regime which applies when the binary is very far apart, and in this like strongly nonlinear regime where the binary is very close by, there's actually exists the intermediate regime, which we will call it as the weakly nonlinear regime. And that's the focus of this work. So by weakly nonlinear here, I mean that inside the white dwarf, there are still a set of discrete eigenmodes. But right now we allow the modes to interact with each other, especially through this global parametric instability. That's where the nonlinearity comes in. And then in the plot shown in the bottom, we compare the threshold energy of this global effect, so shown in the blue trace, versus the local effect considered previously in the orange. And also shown as a comparison is the linear tidal energy. So here we remove the resonant peaks to make things slightly cleaner. And the point is, the global nonlinear instability happens at a much lower threshold energy than the local effects considered previously. And roughly speaking, for white dwarf binaries in the orbital period between 10 minutes to somewhere like 2 or 3 hours, they are all in this global nonlinear, they are all in this weakly nonlinear region. And that's another motivation why we want to study this effect here. So on slide 8, let me give you a brief give a picture like what this parametric instability is. So that's illustrated in the cartoon on the left. So here first we have the tide excites a parent mode whose eigen frequency matches the tidal driving frequency. And then the parent gets resonantly excited. If the parent mode is energetic enough, it can parametrically excite a pair of daughters whose summed frequency match the parent mode's frequency. And then, so that's the parametric instability here. And then the daughters, they will grow exponentially. And so if it's only a two generation systems, the daughters can actually overshoot, or they can actually become more energetic than the parent. And that basically means the daughter generation can further parametrically excite granddaughter generations. And this process basically keeps going on and until the whole system reaches a nonlinear saturation. So here on the right, we show a snapshot of how the saturated system would look like. So the top panel, we show the mode energy as a function of time. And here is only like a very brief period of time. And here in the top panel, we have color-coded modes with different by their generation. And the point is that there's no hierarchy between like energy, there's no hierarchy in energy in terms of mode generation, but instead different modes, they basically reach an equipartition of energy. And whereas the single mode's energy as a function of time is basically chaotic, the total sum energy or the total energy in the system settles into a steady state. And so is the total energy dissipation rate shown in the bottom panel. So that's the picture of this parametric instability. And we talked about the threshold. Another thing important is the time scale. So here there are two important time scales we need to consider. So one is this gravitational wave decay time scale. So that's shown in the plot in this black dotted trees. So that's how long the orbital will decay due to the gravitational wave radiation. And then another important time scale is this nonlinear growth time scales. So that's shown here in the blue trace. So that's essentially the time for the nonlinear instability to grow. And over a few nonlinear growth time scales, the system will settle into this nonlinear equilibrium. And then there's another time scale, this T delta, but T delta is kind of more technical. That's basically characterized like how often do we need to update members inside the mode network. So it's less important here. Let's not focus on that. But just focus on the gravitational wave time scale and the nonlinear growth time scale. And from the plot, we see that there's a very nice separation between the two time scales. In order to utilize this nice separation in timescales, our approach to study the nonlinear tide is the following. So basically, we will first perform the full mode network integrations at a few representative orbital periods. So because those integration involves a large nonlinear mode network, it's very computationally expensive, so we only trace track such system over like tens of nonlinear growth timescales, so that corresponds to days or months, so that the system settles into the equilibrium state. And then based on those numerical results, we will try to come up with some semi-analytical feeds that describes the nonlinear dissipation rate. And then we will use those phenomenological models to further study the long-term evolution of the system over the gravitational wave decay timescale, and that corresponds to like tens of millions of years. And then at the same time, we will try to see what kind of observational signatures we can derive. So move on, let's consider first this some energy dissipation rates at representative orbital periods. So here on, in this plot, we show a zoomed in where we consider the energy dissipation rate around the linear resonant peak. So let's focus on the top panel where we show the energy dissipation rate as a function of orbital period. So here the x-axis is chosen such that it spans half the mode separation. Here in the black trace is the energy dissipation rate calculated in the linear theory. And we can see that it's essentially nothing everywhere else except for this exact resonance. And then in the markers, those are the energy dissipation rates we obtain from the full numerical integration. And here the key point is that we do see that the nonlinear dissipation rate depends on the parent mode detuning. I mean, it's not as severe or as dramatic as the linear theory, but still we do see from the numerical data that there's a dependence on the parent mode detuning. So how do we model this? And it turns out that we can just seek an effective theory which has a similar form as the linear theory. So specifically, we can write the energy dissipation rate as a product of a damping term and the effective energy. So for the effective energy, we give it the same Lorentzian profile as the linear theory, but we just replace the damping term, the linear damping term by an effective nonlinear damping term. And then this effective nonlinear damping term is actually characterized by the nonlinear growth rate. So the great growth rate of the instability, and that actually kind of makes sense. And the key here is that whereas the linear damping is independent of energy, this theory is nonlinear in the sense that the damping rate now itself is a function of the energy. So that's where the nonlinearity comes in. And then using this relatively simple model, we obtain the predicted energy dissipation rate is shown in this blue trace, and we see that it sort of captures the feature of the numerical data.
To interrupt, can I ask a question?
Yes.
So are you talking about the energy dissipated in one parent mode into the coupling to the other modes, the daughter modes?
So I'll say that the stream mode coupling itself is conservative, and the here by dissipation we really mean I'll say each mode will dissipate the energy linearly, and then we just sum all those dissipation rates. So both the parent mode dissipation, the daughter dissipation, and granddaughter dissipation, we sum all the dissipations together to obtain the total dissipation rate of the system.
Okay, but what I'm trying to understand, it's really energy dissipation into coupling with other modes. Or are you putting viscosity, or are you dissipating into? So I'm trying to understand where the energy is being dissipated.
So I'll say the stream mode coupling allows say the energy transfer from the parent to the daughter. And then once the daughter gets energy, they will just dissipate linearly. So the daughter will have like a linear dissipation due to radiative diffusion. Okay. And the daughters, they're more dissipative because they have like shorter wave number, they have smaller wave number, and the dissipation goes as wave number square.
Thank you.
That's the picture here. Thanks for asking this question. It's actually very important here. Let's go back and So in the previous slide, we considered the total energy dissipation around the resonant peak. So that's over a very small range of orbital period. And then we can also consider the same energy dissipation rate over a large range of orbital periods. So that's shown on slide 12. So as we mentioned previously, is that in this nonlinear theory, the energy dissipation rate still depends on the parent mode detuning. And that's why here we see a series of peaks and troughs that corresponds to the resonance and off-resonance of the parent mode. And the key feature here to notice is that the spread between the peak and trough is reduced as the orbital period decreases, or essentially as the binary becomes more and more compact. And this is exactly due to the fact that in this nonlinear theory, or this effective nonlinear theory, the damping term itself is proportional to the square root of energy. So as the binary gets closer and closer, the energy is there's more energy in the tide, and so that means more damping, and that spreads. So that spreads out the peak more and more, and that's why we see the peak trough spreading gets reduced. And this feature is also matches well of our numerical simulation. That's why we kind of think probably this is our effective model here is probably a decent model to describe the nonlinear dissipation. And then we will from this point on we will just assume that model is correct and use it to study the tidal synchronization problem. So here, a cartoon of this process is drawn here. So the idea is that the companion first raises a tidal bulge, and then because of the dissipation, the bulge will lag behind the companion a little bit. And then, so that allows a torque transfer between the orbit and the star, and which eventually allows the white dwarf to be spun up. And here, because of the constant orbital decay, the synchronization condition is actually given by that the spin evolution rate will match the orbital evolution rate. So instead of the spin frequency itself matches the orbital frequency itself. So in this constant decaying system, the synchronization condition is given by this part is the omega s dot equals to the omega orbit dot instead of the two frequency exactly matches each other. And here there are two important questions we would like to ask. So what the first one is relatively simple is just that for initially, if we assume the white dwarf is initially non-rotating, then at which orbital period can we first have this synchronization condition be met? And then the second question is, say, once the synchronization condition is satisfied, can this condition be maintained throughout the rest of the evolution? So to answer the first question, we still consider this energy dissipation rate model. And here we still assume the white dwarf to be non-rotating first. So to answer the first question, we only need to compare two timescales. One is the timescale associated with the spin up of the white dwarf. And then the other timescale is this gravitational wave decay timescale shown here. So in the plot, the spin up timescale is shown in this blue traces for the nonlinear model, for the weakly nonlinear model. And then the gravitational wave decay timescale is shown in this black dashed line. And we can see that at roughly an orbital period of 15 minutes, that this condition will be the synchronization. So the spin up timescale will first be shorter than the gravitational wave timescale. And that means at roughly 15 minutes, we will expect the system to be roughly synchronized to reach this synchronization condition. And then to answer the second question, so can this synchronization condition be maintained through the rest of the evolution? Let's consider some scaling relations of the time scales. So notice here that when we consider the scaling relation, we separate out the frequency dependence into two parts. So one is this omega orb, So that simply comes from the overall tidal amplitude. So that's really just this R over A prefactor, the overall tidal amplitude. And then there's also a part goes as like omega A, small omega A. And that part is due to, the internal mode structure will change as a function of the driving frequency. So the omega, small omega A part characterizes the internal response, how the internal response changes with respect to the driving frequency. And the thing to notice is that if synchronization happens, that means the difference between the omega, between the spin and orbit will stay a constant. And that difference is what drives the tide. So that further means if synchronization happens, then the omega A part will stay as a constant and it stops to evolve. On the other hand, the omega orbit part, the orbital frequency part, that will keeps increasing, will keeps evolving because the orbit is keeps shrinking due to gravitational wave radiation. So the key is if synchronization happens, omega A stops evolving, but omega orbit continues to evolve. And then we can see that for the spin-up timescale, in the nonlinear model, it only goes as omega orbital frequency to the minus 2 power. Whereas for the gravitational wave decay timescale, it goes as omega orbit to the minus 8 over 3. And 2 is less than 8 over 3. So that means the spin-up timescale evolve, that does not evolve as fast as the gravitational wave decay, even at the exact resonant peak. So that further means the synchronization cannot be maintained throughout the rest of the evolution. And this is in contrast to the previous traveling wave model, which depends on the omega orbital frequency as the minus 3 power, and 3 is greater than 8 over 3. So in the traveling wave model, so that's the original study by Fuller and Lai. In that picture, once synchronization happens, it will be maintained throughout the rest of the evolution. Whereas in the traveling wave, in the nonlinear model, this cannot be maintained for the entire evolution. And then we can also see things directly from the full numerical calculated synchronization track or evolution track on slide 15. So here, the top panel shows the frequency evolution as a function of orbital period. So here, this dotted trace is the orbital frequency, and that's mostly driven by gravitational wave decay. And then the solid traces are the spin frequencies. So in red is the prediction based on the old traveling wave model, and the blue trace is our new weakly nonlinear model. And then the dashed trace is the asynchronicity. So that's basically the difference between omega orbit and omega spin. And then as we argued previously, at roughly an orbital period of 15 minutes, that's when this synchronization condition was first met. And then from this point on, we can see that this asynchronicity essentially stops evolving and it stays as roughly a constant. So for the nonlinear model, the weakly nonlinear model and the traveling wave model, there's some slight difference, but it's kind of minor. So in terms of the spin. But then when we consider the tidal power or the power evolution shown in the bottom panel, we start to see like more obvious differences. So especially those dips in the nonlinear model, but not in the traveling wave model. So here in this bottom plot, in this dashed dotted line is the power radiated away in the gravitational wave. So that's always the dominating source of the, I'll say, that's really always dominating the total energy dissipation. And then the solid trace is the total energy transferred into the tide. So this energy both spins up the white dwarf and also produces heat. And the amount of energy that producing heat, we specifically show it in this dotted trace. So we still use this color red to represent the old traveling wave model, and then color blue to represent the new weakly nonlinear model. So the first thing to notice, let's first consider the traveling wave model. So the thing to notice here is that once synchronization happens, for the traveling wave model, the heating rate will follow a smooth power law evolution. Its evolution with respect to the orbital period will be a smooth power law. And that's a consequence of this synchronization condition, which further dictate which enforce the heating rate to be governed by the gravitational wave decay. We should point out that although in our study, we just used the simple power law to approximate the traveling wave torque. And if we put in the realistic scattering of this torque with respect to the driving frequency, we put in those realistic scattering. Once the synchronization condition happens, for the subsequent evolution, the heating rate will still follow the smooth power law, and that's exactly due to this synchronization condition. And this is actually also why the new nonlinear model overall will have a very similar heating rate as the previous traveling wave model, despite the microphysics, the mass microphysics is very different for the two processes, but overall the heating rates are very similar. And that's because when both things are synchronized or when this synchronization condition is met, then the heating rate is no more governed by the internal microphysics, but it's simply governed by this very clean point particle gravitational wave decay. But there is one difference in the nonlinear model is that we notice that there are those like dips in the heating rate, in both the heating rate and the total tidal energy transfer rate. And those dips are actually the exact results that in the nonlinear model, the synchronization cannot be maintained indefinitely, and which we argue from this power law dependence. So in the nonlinear wave, the synchronization can only be approximately maintained for a period of time, and then it will evolve out of synchronization. And this process can also be illustrated in this zoomed in plot shown in the bottom right. So here, the top panel will show the asynchronicity. So that's the difference between the that's the orbital frequency minus the spin frequency. And here, the three bands, shaded bands, corresponds to three parent mode resonance. And then in the bottom panel, we show the comparison between the two timescales, the gravitational wave decay timescale and the spin-up timescale. The message here is that, so when the asynchronicity or when the tidal driving hits the resonance of a parent mode, when things are on resonance, the two timescales are very similar to each other. They match each other very closely. However, their difference keeps increasing as the orbital decays or evolves in time. So the difference between the two timescales keeps increasing. And that also makes the asynchronicity slowly increases with respect to time. And eventually to a point that the asynchronicity becomes so large that the parent mode is no more on resonance. And then when the parent mode evolves out of resonance, then that corresponds to a sudden drop in the tidal torque transfer, in the tidal torque. And that corresponds to those dips. And we should point out that when the system evolves out of resonance, the spin is no more synchronized with the orbit. So essentially the spin up time scale becomes infinity and then the spin stops to evolve. So that's why when it becomes out of synchronization or when the system evolves out of resonance, the heating rate is no more governed by the gravitational wave decay, but then it starts to be determined by the internal physics of the white dwarf. So what are some observational consequences for that? Well, so let's first consider things in electromagnetic radiation. So we can One thing we didn't mention explicitly is that the location where the heat is generated. So it turns out for white dwarfs, the heats are mostly generated very close to the surface. And the thermal diffusion timescale there is much shorter compared to the orbital decay timescale. So therefore, we would expect that the tidal heating can efficiently diffuse out and contribute to the total luminosity of the white dwarf. And in fact, the tidal heating rate should serve as a lower limit of the observed luminosity for a white dwarf. Because, I mean, it's only the lower limit because there will also be luminosity from the intrinsic white dwarf cooling. On the other hand, observationally, the CO white dwarf in this like JO651 system, so that's the 30-minute system, the CO white dwarf, the observed luminosity is actually a factor 10 below the previous prediction using the traveling wave model. And as we argued previously, because of the synchronization condition, it's actually very hard to get any scatter out of this traveling wave model because the heating rate is really determined by the gravitational wave decay rate, and that is a smooth function. So it's really hard to get to explain this factor 10 discrepancy. On the other hand, if we consider our new nonlinear model, as we show that there will be this little dips in the heating rate, and if we're super lucky that this CO white dwarf in this 30-minute system, it happens to reside in such a deep, the luminosity will actually be, the tidal heating rate is actually consistent with the observed luminosity. So that's kind of interesting. But on the other hand, I should confess that this is not very likely. We can estimate the chance to find a system that will reside in this deep region instead of the smooth region. And then it turns out that this is only like a 1% chance. So it's not very likely for us to see such a system. And also another important caveat is that in this study, we ignore the background, the variation in the background structure due to the tidal heating. And that can in fact can be important when the binary is sufficiently close by and the heating rate is significantly higher than the intrinsic luminosity of the white dwarf. So that's a caveat. That's basically the consequence in the electromagnetic observation. And now we can switch gear to talk about gravitational waves. And in the previous part, we focused on systems that are kind of in this 10 to 2 hour range, because we want to contrast the difference between the nonlinear model and the previous traveling wave model. Here, for the gravitational wave, let's just focus on very compact systems whose orbital period is less than 5 minutes. So for those systems, they should be well within this strongly nonlinear regime or the traveling wave regime. And for those systems, we assume the synchronization condition is maintained throughout their evolution. And so that kind of simplifies the analysis here. And the idea is that because of the tidal dissipation, the orbital evolution is accelerated because right now there's a new channel that dissipates the orbital energy. So in addition to the gravitational wave radiation, the tide, the white dwarfs themselves can also help dissipate some amount of the orbital energy. And then from this excess defacing, it turns out that we can measure the moment of the inertia of the white dwarf. So that's the only new parameter introduced to this problem. And here in the plot, we show that the fractional error obtained using a Fisher matrix analysis for the white dwarf moment of inertia as a function of the gravitational wave frequency. So here the gravitational wave frequency is the frequency where the white dwarf binary stars. So that's the frequency. When we start the observation, the initial frequency of the white dwarf binary. And to give you some numbers, if we assume a 5-year observation, the frequency resolution we can achieve is on the order like tens of 10 nanohertz or slightly better than that. And then because we focus on systems that are very, very compact, the amount of frequency evolution is on the order like 1 to 100 microhertz, which is much greater than the frequency resolution. And that's why we can distinguish the tidal effect from the point particle effect, because they follow a different, so they have different dependence on the frequency. And because here we can see the amount of frequency evolution is much greater than the frequency resolution. So we can actually see the entire evolution track instead of just F dot measurement. I mean, so that's what allows us to distinguish the tidal effect from the point particle gravitational wave effect. Or in other words, it just says like, in this analysis, we do not assume a priori that we know the chirp mass of the system. We treat the chirp mass also as an unknown. Even without knowing the chirp mass, we can still measure the moment of inertia from this excess defacing to a very good accuracy, like better than 1%. If the white dwarf starts from, say, like higher than 10 millihertz, if the initial frequency of the white dwarf system is higher than tens of millihertz. So that basically means there's a very bright future for observing those systems in gravitational waves. And here in the plot, we compare both LISA, so that's the millihertz mission, and also this Tango in orange, so that's the new mission we're developing at Caltech. So in this next slide, let me just like sneak in an advertisement for this Tango concept. So we have published a science case paper on archive for this mission. So its sensitivity curve is shown in this plot, in this blue trace. The key point is that it's sensitive from 10 millihertz to tens of, it's from 10 millihertz to 10 hertz. So that's its sensitive band. And it is essentially a LIGO in space. It's much smaller than LISA, and hopefully it can be cheaper than LISA. And in the previous slide, we have shown that this new mission has comparable sensitivity to white dwarf binaries as LISA. But because it's sensitive to a higher frequency range, it can actually also allow for multi-band observation of gravitational of those like ground-based detector sources. And it turns out those like multi-band observation is very good for source localization, and that is further important for things like cosmography or that sort of things. So I would recommend you to have a look of this Tango paper on archive. So for more details there. And with that, I'll just conclude the talk. So some take-home message are summarized in this slide. The key point is that for white dwarf systems, it is in this weakly nonlinear regime, which we consider if its orbit is between like 10 to 2 hours, and the nonlinearity is captured by a phenomenological model. So here, if essentially we propose a effective nonlinear rate, a nonlinear damping rate, and this damping rate is characterized by the nonlinear growth time scale or nonlinear growth time rate, nonlinear growth rate, and itself is a function of energy. So this is in contrast to the linear theory where the damping is independent of energy. In the nonlinear theory, the damping term itself is a function of energy. And we show that the evolutional track is overall similar to the previous traveling wave prediction. And that's a direct consequence of the synchronization condition. However, in the tidal heating specifically, we see that there are those like extra dips. And that's because the synchronization is not maintained in the nonlinear model because of this power law scaling we argued. The in the traveling in the nonlinear weakly nonlinear model, the the system goes in and out synchronization. And each time it goes out of synchronization, it corresponds to a deep. And that deep might be able to explain the observed luminosity of this 30-minute system. But honestly, I won't take it very seriously because it's not a very likely scenario. It's only 1% of chance. And lastly, we show that in gravitational waves, the white dwarf moment of inertia can be measured very well for a detector if it's sensitive to tens of millihertz. So that's all of the talk. And thanks for listening. And I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I see some hands up. Eric, you had a question?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for a great talk. That was really interesting. So at places during the talk, you were comparing your predictions from the weakly nonlinear treatment to a fully nonlinear, to the strongly nonlinear model based on the standing wave approximation. So can you say a little bit more about the strongly nonlinear regime? And also, is there a way for you to smoothly go from your weakly nonlinear to the strong nonlinear? So can you basically match your predictions?
So for the first question, like the strongly nonlinear, it corresponds to this like local wave breaking. So the idea here is that in the linear or weakly nonlinear picture, the white dwarfs still have like a set of discrete eigenmodes, and by eigenmodes that basically means standing waves inside the cavity, inside the wave propagation cavity, and that basically means each time as the wave propagates to the outer boundary, most of the wave gets reflected back, so that's why it can form this like standing wave. And then the strongly nonlinear case is that the wave has so high an amplitude that when it propagates to the outer boundary, it just breaks there linear. It just breaks there locally. So there's no reflection back. In the strongly nonlinear case, the wave is it only propagates one way. From the place where it gets excited by tide, propagate to the outer surface and gets absorbed there, and there's no reflection back. So because there's no reflection back, there's no standing wave anymore. So the mode picture does not hold anymore in the strongly nonlinear case. And then for the second question, unfortunately, it's kind of hard to smoothly transition from the weakly nonlinear to the strongly nonlinear. However, it's easy for us to smoothly transition from the purely linear to the weakly nonlinear regime. So the transition from the linear to weakly nonlinear is actually smooth, and that can simply be achieved by treating this damping term as the sum of this nonlinear damping and the linear damping. So when the nonlinear effect is very weak, it's dominated by the linear damping, and then the whole dissipation rate reduces to the linear theory. And then as the energy gets cranked up, the nonlinear effect overtakes the damping rate, and then it smoothly transitions to this weakly nonlinear regime.
Right. So this is something I understand. So the strong nonlinear stuff is something I've never seen before. I'm a relativist, so I'm not too versed on these astrophysics things. But so would you say that the strong nonlinear model based on the breaking of a traveling wave, I mean, is that very crude? Is that sophisticated? Is that something we can believe in? I mean, what's your judgment on that model?
I mean, it's kind of crude, but also it's really hard to model the local nonlinear effect because that relies on like, you know, local waves that they usually have like super high. I mean, if we want to resolve them numerically, that requires incredibly high resolution. So that's very hard to be done in the numerically, and so what those people do is really they enforce the boundary conditions such that when the wave propagates to the outer boundary, there's no the wave is only like one directional. It only propagates out to the surface, but there's no reflection, and that's the only thing, or that's how they enforce the strongly nonlinear condition. But so that's the only thing they do, and it's it's kind of hard to judge how realistic this is. I mean, it's sort of like a physical. It sounds reasonable, but I don't know how to rigorously like validate this model. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. No. Don't be sorry. It's very it's a very good answer.
And Juan, I see you had a question.
Well, to follow Eric's question, so you show the comparison, right? For the numerosity versus period, and for one system, the numerosity is smaller than the model prediction by this traveling wave approximation. I mean, it's just one model. You observe a lot of white dwarfs. Like, how do other white dwarfs fit in this model? Do they fit well with this traveling wave prediction?
It's a little bit tricky because we can see that the heating is really tiny for those like systems like that are at relatively long orbital periods, so like longer than 20 minutes or so. And there we expect the heating to be buried by the intrinsic luminosity due to white dwarf cooling. So it's hard to see. I mean, most of the white dwarfs we know that they're relatively far apart, and there are only like very very few around this like 10 or you know around 10-ish minutes, and that's when we expect the tidal heating to be more significant than the intrinsic luminosity, and unfortunately, like both the 30-minute system and the 7-minute system, the current model does not fit any of those. And the tricky part is, because there's this like synchronization condition, it's actually at long period we can have like all kinds of scattering due to the internal physics, due to the white dwarf structure, but once they evolve into this synchronized regime, everything will be governed by this clean gravitational wave decay. So the microphysics does not play a role, or does not play a significant role anymore, and that's why like it's actually kind of hard to get scattering. Although it's only factor 10, but it's actually hard to get this scatter out from the original tidal models.
Okay, so my another question I have. So it seems this parametric instability you're considering has this requirement, right? So the frequency of the paramode equal to the sum of the frequencies of the daughter modes. So I remember when Nevin Weinberg and others consider this nonlinear instability for neutron stars, they had a different criteria for parametric instabilities. So it seems they did not require the frequency to match. Instead, they require the spatial frequency to match. This tidal PG, whatever stuff.
Yes.
And I mean, my question is whether the mechanism also applies here. So you don't require frequency to match. So you also see tidal PG nonlinearities in these white dwarfs.
We haven't considered the PG part because that's honestly the theory behind it is a little bit not so well understood as the frequency matching one. The short answer is that no, we haven't considered the PG in the white dwarf context carefully. And here we just focus on this like the more traditional frequency matching parametric instability. The PGs that would require like very, very high frequency, I'll say the spatial resonance between a higher order P mode and higher order G mode. And it's a little bit tricky because the, it's just I'll say the, there are some like subtlety in the physics that we do not understand very well. And also I should mention that the PG is important because the, in the neutron star case, there are lots of, I'll say the, it's the equilibrium tide that dominates. So then it's very hard to get the parametric instability from the equilibrium tide. And that's why you need to rely on this PG type of thing. Whereas here in the white dwarfs, we have a strong dynamical tide. And for the dynamical tide, it's probably the regular, this like frequency matching parametric instability plays the more important role.
Okay, thanks.
So maybe I can ask a quick question. So maybe you said this and I missed it, but so you're talking about this observation of J0651 and how the nonlinear model could be consistent with it if you happen to just be in this dip, but that was only a 1% chance. So assuming that that's not the case and that you're not in a dip, what would be the explanation for that? Does that point to some like missing physics in this model? And do you have any particular part that you suspect that could be an explanation for that?
I think actually the other thing we're thinking is really the adjustment of the background structure. So here when we do this study, we just first like say consider a white dwarf model at a fixed temperature, and then we calculate all the couplings inside this white dwarf, specific white dwarf model. But then as the system evolves continuously, there will be heat pumping from the essentially there will be heat generated inside the white dwarf, and that may change the structure of the white dwarf a little bit, or in that case, the synchronization condition is will actually be rewritten as say omega s dot minus omega orbit or omega orbit dot minus omega s dot equals to omega a dot. So if we fix the background model, the omega a, so the eigen frequency of the mode will stay a constant. But then if we allow the background to change due to this thermal effect, then we may actually have like omega A also evolving, and that can also break this. So that's a way to make the system not locked to the point particle decay, but that allows some more freedom. And that could potentially make the heating rate lower. So we're actually thinking about a follow-up project to address this more qualitatively. So I think a more natural explanation should go somewhere. The more natural explanation might be due to the adjustment of the background structure due to tidal heating.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so if there are no other questions, I guess we can all thank Hongyu again for the very nice talk.
Okay, yeah, thanks for inviting me here. Yeah.